And now, it's time for our weekly news round, Lutheran Radio News with Paul Hill.
Over 900,000 Christians have been martyred in the last 10 years. A Christian research firm affiliated with Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, Massachusetts, estimates. Gordon Conwell Center for the Study of Global Christianity recently released its annual report on the persecution of Christians, which found that as many as 90,000 Christians died for their faith in the last year. Although the study was released this month, the finding that 90,000 Christians, or one Christian every 6 minutes, were killed in 2016 was leaked by a prominent Italian sociologist named Massimo Intervini during an interview with Vatican Radio in December, and the report received much media attention before it was even released. Even though 90,000 Christian martyrs might seem a lot in 1 year, the think tank maintains that 90,000 Christians have died each year, on average, from 2005 to 2015. In the last week, several news organizations reported on the persecution of Christians around the world and cited our figure of 90,000 Christian martyrs in 2016, the organization said in an email to supporters. The Center for the Study of Global Christianity has done extensive research on Christian martyrdom, both historical and contemporary. We estimate that between 2005 and 2015, there were 900,000 Christian martyrs worldwide, an average of 90,000 per year. It should be noted that 90,000 Christian martyrs per year is a very liberalist estimate. In fact, the organization notes that only 30% of the 90,000 Christians were killed because of terrorism. 70% of the 90,000 Christians were actually killed in tribal conflicts in Africa, which raises the question of whether or not 70% of 90,000 Christians were actually killed over their faith, or just victims of violent conflicts. In the email, the center explained the definition of martyr is used for its study. Two of the qualifying factors for martyr is that slain Christians must have been in the situation of witness and have been killed as a result of hostility. Witness in this definition is not restricted to public testimony concerning belief in Jesus, the email explains. It refers to the individual's entire lifestyle, regardless of whether or not he or she was actively proclaiming at the time of death. The email adds that the definition of the result of hostility takes a variety of forms, including war, conflict, random killing and genocide, and includes acts by both individuals or groups such as governments, and this excludes death through accidents, crashes, illness or acts of nature. Last week, the Christian persecution watchdog Open Doors USA released its 2017 World Watch list of top 50 countries where Christians face the most persecution. Open Doors estimates that a little over 1,200 Christians were killed for their faith around the globe from November 1, 2015 to October 31, 2016. However, that is a conservative estimate since it only includes documented cases and doesn't include statistics from North Korea and areas of Iraq and Syria, where the Islamic State has killed thousands of people over the last 2 years. According to Open Doors, Christian persecution across the world has steadily increased over the last 3 years, and 2016 was the worst year of persecution on record. Center for the Study of Global Christianity also found that Christians are the most persecuted religious group throughout the world. Most Christians still believe sermons are important, but wish vicars would stop trying to be funny. In a survey launched by Resonate last year, only 1.6 participants said they saw humour to be the most important element in a sermon. Men in particular said they felt biblical exposition to be the most important aspect in a sermon, at 49%, with women at 39%. Sermons containing more practical application elements were seen more favourably by women, at 42% versus 36% for men. When asked if they felt sermons on the whole were outdated, 88% of the respondents either disagreed or strongly disagreed. Resonate's research was cited by the Daily Telegraph in an article about churchgoers' preferences when it comes to the content of sermons. Is a sound as familiar in British churches as organ music or an echoing cough from the back row? But the familiar ritual of congregations raising a faint titter as the vicar attempts another toe-curling joke or rambling anecdote could become a thing of the past if the finding of this research are taken to heart by clerics. According to the research, churchgoers rather clergy stick to serious topics and leave the jokes to comedians. A survey of Christians found that they ranked weighty explanations of the Bible as 27 times as important in a sermon as humor, and practical application 42 times more highly than personal anecdote. The findings come from the research commissioned by the Christian Resources Exhibition, a trade fair for all things clerical, which took place at the Excel Centre in London. For the first time, organisers ran a Sermon of the Year competition. A poll of almost 1,400 regular churchgoers commissioned for the event found a perhaps surprising appetite for longer sermons, with less than 1% favouring a talk of under 5 minutes, but 36% favouring a monologue of between 20 and 30 minutes. When asked to choose the most important element in a sermon from a list of choices, 44.3% favoured biblical exposition, and only 1.6% opted for a sense of humour. Similarly, practical application was the second most popular choice, garnering 40% of support, compared with just under 1% for personal anecdotes. Lord Carey, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, said, "I'm a great believer in humour. There is nothing worse than a boring sermon. Just 2 minutes of a boring sermon can be almost like geological time. It goes on forever. I believe in proper use of humour, if it is relevant. A really good joke can do two things. It can link in with the address and give it a bit of breathing space. Even in Parliament, when someone uses humour, it relaxes people and takes some of the heaviness out of an address. But it has to be in the right place." The survey also asked for participants' views on male and female preachers. Although the vast majority said they had no preference in terms of a preacher's gender, out of the 21% who did, 20% said they preferred men, while only 1% said women. This comes from more than 20 years after women were accepted into ordained ministry in the Church of England, combined with women's ministry being an accepted part of many Christian denominations. However, in terms of young people, most of the respondents felt they were not given enough opportunities to preach in church. 48% said they felt chances for those under 21 to mount the pulpit were lacking, with only 30% feeling they were not. The survey also asked for people's views on their relationship with the Bible and the internet. Although 49% said they saw the internet as a good chance to engage with non-Christians, and nearly 30% said they use social media to share their Christian views and opinions, 64% said they do not use online relationships purely to promote the Bible. A World War I soldier was saved when a pocket Bible he was carrying in his pocket stopped a German bullet from hitting his heart. Leonard Knight, 17, put the Bible in the breast pocket of his uniform when he was shot at by an enemy. The round penetrated the hardback front cover, but was stopped from travelling any further by the thickness of the book. Incredibly, the bullet halted after around 50 pages from the end, and Leonard escaped without a scratch. The teenager had been given the book by his Aunt Minnie Yates, who wrote a note inside it saying, "To Leonard, with love from Aunt Minnie, July 1915. It is not known what happened to the young soldier after the near miss, or where exactly it took place, although it is believed to have survived the war. His Bible, which still has the bullet embedded inside, has now been passed down through 5 generations of his aunt's family, and is currently in the hands of Paula Ryan, 60, and her daughter Claire. Claire, who is the great-great-granddaughter of Minnie Yates, found out about the Bible when her grandmother Sheila Cater brought it out to show the family. The 30-year-old and activities coordinator at a nursing home in Bristol said, "My granny had been given it and was passed to her, and now it's been passed on again. She was so proud of it and kept it in a special biscuit tin on the top shelf of a wardrobe. She used to get it out every now and again when I was little, but I didn't quite understand. I just knew that it was really precious." The teenager had been given the book by his Aunt Minnie Yates, who wrote a note inside. "I imagine it had been covering Leonard's heart. The bullet had gone quite far through. There's probably about 50 pages before the end of the book, and it's quite a thick Bible. Leonard was born in 1898 and grew up in Wychbold, Worcestershire, but he disappeared after the conflict, and information about wartime service is scarce. It is believed that Leonard lived into his 70s, but suffered with post-traumatic stress disorder after seeing the horrors of the war." Claire added, "He disappeared after the war, so no one knew what happened to him. I think my granny showed the Bible to the Imperial War Museum once, but she never followed it up, and it was hard to keep touch back then." Claire came forward with the Bible after spotting an online appeal to find Princess Mary gift tin boxes given to soldiers during the First World War. She saw a video of one of the tins with a bullet hole through its cover on social media. and Leonard's Bible sprang to mind. Her mother, Paula, tried to track down the family's history to learn more about Leonard and what happened to him during and after the war, but to no avail. She said, "I've tried to get hold of the military records, but a lot of the MOD records from the First World War were destroyed during the Second World War." Family members of the 9 people Dylan Roof killed in Charleston, South Carolina church weren't the only ones who suffered. The church family grieved too. Along with the 32 family members of victims, 3 people connected to Emmanuel AME Church spoke as Roof was formally sentenced to death last week in a federal court. "When you have attended 9 wakes and 9 funerals, it is heartbreaking," said Ruby Martin, the most senior member of the church, who admitted it took her several weeks after the 2015 shootings before she could go back. Emotions expressed at the hearing included laughter and tears, love and hate, anger and forgiveness, despair and hope. Some people shouted at Roof, wishing him to be condemned to hell. Others offered forgiveness, and one said she would visit him in prison as he waits execution for the slaughter. A jury sentenced Roof to death on hate crime and obstruction of religion charges. U.S. District Judge Richard Gergel couldn't change it, but his words left little doubt. He felt death was justified. "This hate, this viciousness, this moral depravity will not go unanswered," he said. The 22-year-old avowed white supremacist didn't look at Gergel, just as he refused to meet the gaze of anyone who spoke that week, including Janet Scott, an aunt of 26-year-old Tuzanza Sanders, the youngest victim killed in the June 17, 2015 massacre. "Dylan," Scott said quietly as she started speaking. "Dylan, Dylan," she said, shouting it the last time. Towards the end of her remark, she said, "I wish you would look at me, boy." Roof didn't take an opportunity to speak on that Wednesday. The day before, just before jurors deliberated his sentence, he didn't ask for mercy or apologize, instead saying he still felt like I had to do it. Sheila Capers, the sister-in-law of Cynthia Hurd, 54, who was killed, said she prayed for Roof's soul to be saved. "If at any point before you are sentenced and you're in prison and you want me to come and pray with you, I will do that," Capers said. Felicia Sanders, who survived the attack, brought the bullet-torn, blood-stained Bible she had with her on the night of the shooting. She told Roof he still lives in the head, and that when she hears a balloon pop or fireworks or even the soft thud of a falling acorn, she returns to that night. "Most importantly, I can't shut my eyes to pray," Sanders said. On the night of the shooting, Roof sat through a 45-minute Bible study session at the black church known as Mother Emmanuel with 12 others. He opened fire as they stood and closed their eyes for a final prayer. In all, he fired 77 shots. Each victim was hit at least 5 times. The Reverend Daniel Simmons Sr., 74, was among those killed. His daughter, Rose Simmons, said Wednesday that her father, in his final act on earth, extended the hand of friendship and love even to an enemy, and it cost him his life. "So in dying, facing an enemy, I'm sure we can live facing ours." She added, "Love conquers all." 3 people survived the attack. Roof told one of them he was sparing her life so she could tell the world he was killing the worshippers there because he hated black people. When he was arrested, Roof told FBI agents he wanted the shootings to bring back segregation or perhaps start a race war. Instead, the slayings had a unifying effect as South Carolina removed the Confederate flag from its state house for the first time in more than 50 years. Other states followed suit, taking down Confederate banners and monuments. Roof had posed with the flag in photos. The jury convicted Roof last month of all 33 federal charges he faced. He insisted he was not mentally ill and did not call any witnesses or present any evidence. An American team of academics is racing to preserve millions of Cuban historical documents before they are lost to the elements and poor storage conditions. Many of the documents shed light on the slave trade, an integral part of Cuba's colonial history that was intertwined with that of the United States. David Lefevre, a history professor at the University of Texas at Arlington, and his brother Matthew, a geography professor at the University of Alabama, have worked since 2005 to make computer copies of millions of documents moldering in damp storage spaces on the island. Their latest project is a partnership between the British Library Foundation and the Vanderbilt University to capture almost 2 million documents in digital form a treasure trove stretching back to the mid-16th century of documents about early island life and the slave trade. David Lefevre said there is nothing like Cuba's documentary record in the US. Though no less ruthless when it came to slavery than the Anglos to the north, the Spanish recognized the personhood of slaves once they were baptized into the Catholic Church. Their births, marital status, national origin, and deaths were all duly recorded in the town records and stored in church archives, leaving a historical record of blacks and their lives far more detailed than that in the US. Churches became the repository of much of this history because of their central role in island life and because church officials were painstaking documentarians who often were the most educated in their communities, David Lefevre said in an interview. The documents are not only pertinent to the Catholic Church because the church was often the most substantial building in town, so other documents were kept there as well, he said. For instance, while digitizing some documents in the town of Colon, a slave trading post in colonial days that is about 110 miles east of Havana, Lefevre discovered that a nearby town, Ceiba Mocha, was founded by former American slaves who had fled Spanish-ruled Florida onto the mainland. Cuba's Catholic Church has played a major role in the preservation project, granting access to church archives around the island and assisting in identifying important documents. Church officials like Deacon Felix Knight of the colonial Santo Espirito Church in Old Havana, tucked away in a warren of narrow lanes in the city's colonial heart, work with the academics to find and preserve old documents. These books reflect life, aspects of the sacramental life of blacks, obviously of whites also, Knight said. The important thing is to preserve as many of them as possible. It is especially important to preserve the history of the Afro-Cuban community, whose history has not been well documented in Cuba, he added. Slavery wasn't outlawed in Cuba until 1886, and American slavers had used the island as a transshipment point for African slaves destined for U.S. slave markets in the South. We are working to maintain and recover that which is irreplaceable, a legacy. It's a patrimony, a way of seeing that is very personal, Knight said, holding a book from 1674 that contains record of black births, marriages, deaths, and civil status. The process of digitizing the papers can be painstaking. Each ancient volume is carefully removed from storage and placed on a black cloth used for background. Then each page is slowly opened and photographed. An average book can contain hundreds of pages, all in various conditions of preservation, the writing faded from the age and the elements. The leather-bound volumes are remarkably resistant to decay, considering that many are stored in wooden cabinets in places with little climate control, Knight said. Churches were built in the colonial era to maximize airflow in the heavy tropical climate. High ceilings and thick walls kept the interiors of the churches cool and dry, helping to preserve the paper and leather-bound records. And finally, municipal and Roman Catholic Church officials in the Austrian town of Salverden are looking for someone to live in a nearby hermitage built into the steep cliffs characteristic of the Salzburg region. But a second job is advisable. The parish website says the position is unpaid, and because it is unheated and without running water, the hermitage is habitable only between April and November. State broadcaster ORF quoted cleric Aloy Moser as saying the search is on for a person at peace with himself. The cleric said the successful candidate should also have a Christian outlook and be ready to greet visiting pilgrims. The more than 350-year-old building has been uninhabited since the Benedictine monk left in the autumn.
My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you and goodbye for now.
On your PC, tablet, mobile phone and internet radio receiver, this is Lutheran Radio UK.